Last week, an article at MSNBC compared Trump's version of Christianity with Kamala Harris's. The article goes on to say that the 2024 presidential race juxtaposes two very different versions of Christianity. Donald Trump brandishes a performative rendition of the Christian faith as a political prop to advance authoritarian theocracy, while Vice President Kamala Harris practices the Christian faith she was raised in while embracing her interfaith family. This is Richard Nelson, and thank you for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters. So is Donald Trump using authoritarianism as a political prop to advance a theocracy? Is Kamala Harris's view of pluralism in line with America's ideals? Joining us to talk further about this and the topic of Christian nationalism is Mark David Hall, a professor at Regent University's Robertson School of Government. He's also a senior fellow and director of the Religious Liberty in the States Project, the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy. He's the author of several books, including his most recent called Who's Afraid of Christian Nationalism? Mark, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
So I thought that would be a good way to cue up the program by that article in MSNBC. And I want to press in a little further to the Democratic National Convention, which just wrapped up recently. And their Interfaith Council hosted a panel discussion on the topic of Christian nationalism. They had two congressmen who were there and a couple of journalists, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver of Missouri and Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. I want to share with you a couple of comments that they had shared on the panel and then get your feedback. This is what Emanuel Cleaver said. Please remember that the founding fathers were not Christian. Washington was a deist, not a Christian. Thomas Paine, who was central to our whole founding, didn't even believe in God, period. He also went on to say that there's nothing about God in the Constitution. Zero. It's a contradiction. Is this accurate, this understanding of our founding fathers and their relationship to Christianity?
It's almost completely inaccurate. So a couple books ago, I wrote a book entitled, Did America Have a Christian Founding? Which I answer that question with the resounding yes, by which I mean America's founders were influenced profoundly by Christian ideas or ideas developed within the Christian tradition of political reflection. I do spend a little time on the individual faiths of some founders, and it is absolutely accurate to say that Thomas Paine is a deist. I don't think it's accurate to say he's an atheist, though. And yet Thomas Paine only spent about 20 years of his 70 or so years on this earth in America. So he's born in England, grew up in England, spent most of his life in Europe. And so I would say he's a profoundly unrepresentative founder. If we turn our eyes from a Thomas Paine and a Ben Franklin, a Thomas Jefferson, none of whom were Orthodox Christians, to the broader constellation of founders, there's very little reason to believe any of them were atheists and that more than a handful of them were deists in any meaningful sense of the word.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you for clarifying that. I knew that you have written on this, you've spoken on it, and I wanted to bring some clarity. And yet this falsehood, if you will, or this inaccurate understanding of our history is constantly put forward. Perhaps this is just a lack of good teaching and a lack of good scholarship when it comes to the beliefs of our founding fathers. Mark, I want to bring up another comment that I was alarmed to see. This is by a journalist by the name of Catherine Stewart, and she was commenting on religious freedom here in the United States today. She said, Americans like to believe that we have religious freedom, but when you say that, we are kidding ourselves. You say that there's some degree of formal religious freedom in America, but on the ground, some groups have privilege and other groups have to sit in the back room. How does a statement like that grab you? That we don't, she's asserting that we don't have religious freedom, and then maybe formal religious freedom is something that is out there, but there's some groups that have privilege and other groups have to sit in the back of the room. And her implication was that Christians and those in the Christian community have privilege.
So Catherine Stewart is an activist journalist. So is Andrew Seidel, not a journalist, but an activist. And these folks routinely say things like this, that the Supreme Court is privileging Christianity above the other religions. One of the things I do in my recent book, Who's Afraid of Christian Nationalism, is I go through a ream of recent U.S. Supreme Court cases where the justices rule in favor of Muslims, an Islamic woman to wear the hijab, an Islamic man's right to wear a beard in prison. Islamic men's right under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to sue the national government for damages is just utterly and completely false. In fact, Luke Goodrich did a great study where he shows that religious minorities are far more likely to be protected by the Religious Freedom Restoration Act than are Christians. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because there is a sense in which inadvertently, I think, sometimes minority religions are discriminated against. So the Arkansas case I mentioned involving the prisoner, the Arkansas Criminal Justice Division or whatever, basically said all prisoners must be clean shaven. It's a little bit more complicated than that. Well, for most Christians, this isn't a problem, right? But for Muslims, Muslim men are told that they must have facial hair. And so that general neutrally applicable law inadvertently impacts Islamic men in their ability to live out their faith. So very fortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and say, no, Arkansas, you can't do this. You must permit Islamic prisoners to grow facial hair if required by the dictates of conscience.
Yeah, very good. Another journalist on this panel, and I'm going to butcher this name, Coyote Y. Josh, he said this: we see how Christianity is embedded in our legal and social infrastructure. What we see throughout U.S. history is that Protestant Christianity is present in our immigration laws, how SCOTUS justices have made their decisions. And then he goes on, because we are not taught to see those, we do not understand the impact of this on today. This is Christian privilege. Another way to think about privilege is advantage. Christianity has been advantaged from the get-go all throughout. And we've got to start realizing that. We've got to make that which has been invisible visible. So again, he's drilling down on this idea that there is some kind of Christian privilege in our laws and in our society. Respond to that, if you would, Mark.
So I think there's a very important sense in which this is the case. So in the late 18th century, 98% of Americans of European descent are Protestants. The other 2% are Roman Catholic. And there's about 2,000 Jews in four or five American cities. And so lo and behold, there's an assumption that the nation will kind of run on the Christian calendar. So for instance, the pocket veto occurs 10 days after Congress passes a law, Sunday's exempted. So there's an assumption that Congress will not be doing business on the Sabbath. You think about the school calendar. No school district, of which I'm aware, holds school on Sunday. And even though we call it winter break nowadays, winter break conveniently falls over the Christmas season so that Christians are able to celebrate the holiday of Christmas. One of the projects I direct is a Religious Liberty in the States project. And one of the laws we look at is whether or not states require school districts to give students excused absences for religious holidays. Now, this almost solely impacts religious minorities. So a high holy day for Jews might fall on a Wednesday, where school would usually be held in session. And so they would be required to be given an excused absence so that they could celebrate that holiday. So all of which is to say, I think there's truth in that fundamentally, there is a degree of privilege that Christians are granted. And yet I'm firmly in favor of protecting religious minorities whenever possible, even going way out of our way to protect them, as in the case with these excused absences for religious holidays, which almost solely benefit non-Christians.
That's good. Mark, let's go to your book. Your recent book is called Who's Afraid of Christian Nationalism? Why Christian Nationalism is Not an Existential Threat to America or the Church. You mentioned in your book that beginning in about 2006, there were a good number of left-leaning academics who began using the term Christian nationalism. They warned of the dire threats. They came out churning out books, even though you didn't see Christian leaders using this term or Christians identifying with this idea. Why is that? Did something happen in 2006 around that time that led the political left to respond to this?
Yes, I'm not sure it's anything exactly in 2006. And what you have is a ream of books in the 80s, 90s, and the early aughts decrying the rise of theocracy, the religious right, the moral majority. And the main thing that happened in 2006 is that these terms were then replaced by Christian nationalism. So beginning in 2006, you have a stream of books, oftentimes by journalists or activists like Catherine Stewart, Andrew Seidel, but certainly by academics as well, Andrew Whitehead, Samuel Perry, basically warning of this dire threat to the United States of America. These Christian theocrats are bent on taking America over for Christ and quite literally persecuting everyone except for white Christian males. So all females, all racial minorities, all religious minorities are virtually going to be imprisoned under this threat. And that would be incredibly scary if it was the case. I say this as a white Christian male. I would hate to live in that sort of universe. But of course, as you and I know, there's nothing like that. There's just no sizable movement whatsoever that desires simply and solely to privilege white Christian males above all others.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, Richard Nelson here. There's got to be a better way to engage politics. That's why I wrote a new book focusing on how Christians can lead the way. It's called Christianity and Politics, a memoir of spiritual formation and field guide for Christians in the public arena. This is a refreshing perspective on how believers can engage the political realm, and it's available for pre-order on Amazon today. So please check it out. I think you're going to find it helpful. If you're just joining us, you are tuned in to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm your host, Richard Nelson, here with Mark David Hall, professor of government at Regent University. And we're talking about the topic of Christian nationalism. Mark, it wasn't until the year 2022, that's just 2 years ago, that really the first public significant personality, if you will, identified as a Christian nationalist. And that's Marjorie Taylor Greene. And so we had this scholarship, as we were just talking about, that goes back to 2006. And then all of a sudden you have a prominent congresswoman who receives a lot of national attention, but she came out just 2 years ago and identified as a Christian nationalist. Why did she do that? And how does this reframe the debate? Because she's known as a very conservative, maybe provocative, that might be a good term. But why did she do that? And how does that, because of her personality, does that change this debate and maybe add fuel to the fire or support their arguments that, hey, we should be concerned about Christian nationalists?
Certainly the critics think so. So I want to highlight one of the things you said, but we really should emphasize this. Prior to 2022, almost literally no elected official, no academic, no Christian leader was saying, I am a Christian nationalist. Christian nationalism is a good thing. So Marjorie Taylor Greene is the first elected member of Congress to say, I'm a Christian nationalist. Today, I believe exactly two members of Congress have identified as Christian nationalists. In 2022 as well, you have people like Al Mohler and Doug Wilson come out and say, well, we could salvage the term Christian nationalist, but they weren't embracing it. They weren't utilizing it on their own. I think this is entirely imprudent. And I've said this to a number of these, especially the academic types, to their face. Why would you possibly embrace this label that has only been used as a slur for over a decade? Now, what they all want to do is redefine it. They want to say, well, we don't mean anything sexist or racist or homophobic or militarist by it. We simply mean X, Y, and Z. And I take them at their word. I don't think they're racist, sexist, homophobic, and so forth, but it's just entirely imprudent. So again, it bears emphasizing that almost no Christian leader in the United States of America is out there advocating for Christian nationalism or anything like it.
Mark, I've had a chance to read half of your book, and I'll be very frank and transparent. I wanted to read all of it. I had some other things going on, but what I've read halfway through is very good. Your analysis is fair. You support what you're writing with. You document it very well, as opposed to some of the academics that you critique. And one of those, there's a book written not too long ago called Taking America Back for God. It was written by the academics Whitehead and Perry, and it's been an influential book. It's gotten all kinds of praise. It's been referenced in other books that are criticizing or pushing against the idea of Christian nationalism. So they say in their book, Taking America Back for God, their definition of Christian nationalism is that it is an ideology that idealizes and advocates fusion of American civic life with a particular type of Christian identity and culture. Is that a fair definition of Christian nationalism?
Yeah, that's a fair definition, but it's only the beginning of their definition because they go on to make it crystal clear that Christian nationalism is a toxic blend of racism and sexism and militarism and homophobism. And then they go on to claim that 51.9% of Americans fully or partially embrace this toxic stew. And so this is, I think, just ridiculous. If you read through their study, what they do is they base it on a Baylor survey where people are asked to respond to questions. And the questions go something like this. I'll read some of them. The federal government should advocate Christian values. Now, when I hear that, I think, yeah, Christian values, peace, justice, equality. Absolutely, the federal government should advocate those sorts of things. And so I would be a strong yes on that. The federal government should allow religious displays in public places. Well, when I hear that, I think immediately of the Blandesburg Cross, that World War I era cross in Maryland that the U.S. Supreme Court found to be constitutional by a 7-2 vote, including Breyer and Kagan. So I'd say absolutely. And you go through their every one of their statements could be answered in a particularly innocuous way, and yet score someone like myself as a rabid Christian nationalist, whereas I would reject everything about their definition of Christian nationalism. And so it's just a profoundly flawed study, and they should have known better. But I think they've enjoyed getting all the PR from this outrageous academic work. And this is an academic work published by Oxford University Press that just fundamentally misstates the problem.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Have you ever wondered why America is the most prosperous nation in history? We've certainly been blessed, but we take the conditions for prosperity for granted. That's why CPC is hosting the Toward a Better Bluegrass Conference. We've invited some of the top thinkers and leaders to speak about the sources of our economic strength. Biblical principles, America's founding framework, and individual capacity are a few issues that we'll be addressing. So please join us on October the 18th in Lexington. And for more information, go to our website, commonwealthpolicycenter.org, and we look forward to seeing you there. Mark, I'm going to go to what is driving this, but before that, I want to go to what you're saying, and you touched on it. It's about how they conflate Christian nationalism with a parade of horribles like white supremacy, patriarchy, xenophobia, heteronormativity, authoritarianism, militarism, rejection of science, Islam, or Islamophobia, and cultural dominance. How do they get from what I just started out as their definition, which I think is pretty fair, where they, again, I'll go back to that. They believe it's an ideology that idealizes and advocates fusion of American civic life with a particular type of Christian identity and culture. I can agree with that as a definition, but then they begin to conflate all of these horrible things with Christian nationalism, which you and I think would agree almost to the point there that this is not Christianity. This is not what Orthodox Christians believe today. But here's where I want to pivot to. Why are they doing this? What's at the heart of this? Any ideas?
You know, that's an excellent question. And let me be crystal clear, as I know you know, there are horrible racists in America today, the sort of people who showed up at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. But I think that was about 300 people. And this was from all sorts of groups, the KKK, the Aryan Nation, all sorts of alt-right groups. Yeah, so there are very racist out there, and we should condemn them. If they engage in acts of violence, they should be arrested. We shouldn't tolerate them in any way, shape, or form. But to suggest that 51.9% of Americans fully or partially embrace this view is just utterly ridiculous. So what's driving these people? I think a number of them are activists. I have a book, a chapter in my book called The Polemical Critics, people like Catherine Stewart and Andrew Seidel, who are just clearly activists that are aimed at, I think there's a clear agenda of shaming Christians to suggest we shouldn't bring our faith into the public square. People like Whitehead and Perry are academics, and I think they probably are making a good faith effort to address a problem, to measure a problem that they think is out there. And yet, even in this Oxford University Press book, they let their implicit biases out. For instance, they say that the only reason one is pro-life is because one wants to control women's bodies. That's it. Now, this leaves aside the well-known fact that women are just as likely to be pro-life as men. So what are these women? What is my wife wanting to do? Control other women's bodies? Not at all. She believes that an unborn child is a child and should be protected as a matter of law. They say in this Oxford University Press book that these Christian nationalists believe that religious liberty means more than the freedom to worship. But religious liberty has always meant more than the freedom to worship. The First Amendment begins, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. We have a constitutional right to act upon our religious convictions. And this includes doing things outside of a church, a mosque, or a synagogue, sharing our faith in the public square, wearing a hijab, wearing a yarmulke. It absolutely involves more than the freedom to worship. Obviously, what they have in mind is someone like a Jack Phillips, a cake baker who can't participate in a same-sex wedding ceremony. And that is a part of religious liberty, but it certainly goes well beyond simply being a bigot. So yeah, I think what we have with the academics are implicit biases, whereas with people like Andrew Seidel, you have pretty explicit biases.
I appreciate that clarification. You had mentioned that in their book, they contend that 52% of Americans are fully or partially supportive of Christian nationalism. And you question if that number is accurate. And you write about this. So scholars are supposed to do good scholarship. If you have a survey and come to a certain conclusion, it should be supported by the facts. I mean, you're suggesting that really they came to the faulty conclusions, as you had mentioned just a few minutes ago. What is a more accurate number, if you will, of how many people could reasonably be called Christian nationalists?
So fortunately, and this is the way scholarship is supposed to work, since their book came out, a number of other scholars without any clear agenda have questioned their findings. There have been other surveys that have come out with, I think, far more reasonable understandings of Christian nationalism. And I get to this in one of my latter chapters. So I contend that Christian nationalism is a thing. It basically involves wanting to privilege Christianity above other religions, so that Christian nationalists would like Congress to formally declare America to be a Christian country. Christian nationalists believe that America was founded as a Christian nation. Christian nationalists would like public school teachers to lead children in explicitly Christian prayers. So about 20% of Americans embrace these sorts of views. Let me note that this has nothing to do with racism or sexism or homophobism or militarism. But it definitely involves privileging Christianity above other religions. And I give a number of reasons, biblical, theological, prudential, and constitutional reasons why we should reject even this benign form of Christian nationalism. So I want to make it crystal clear, I'm not in favor of Christian nationalism of any stripe, but I think the actual Christian nationalism that exists in America is far from an existential threat to America's constitutional democracy or to the Christian church, which is one of the things that the critics say. The Christian church in America is on the verge of collapse because of Christian nationalism, and that's just ridiculous.
Mark, I want to thank you on a personal level for doing this work and to, first of all, question some of the academic writings that are really putting Christians in a box, painting us into a corner, labeling us unfairly. But also, you are getting back to what the Constitution says, as you just shared with us a few minutes ago, what the Founding Fathers believed. And I think it's important for whether you're a Christian today or a secularist to really understand that what the Founding Fathers gave us in the Constitution in particular is that we have a political document that upholds basic human rights, the right to life, the right to speech, the right to assemble, the right to worship, right? A framework of rights that are guaranteed by our Constitution, a document that upholds our conscience rights, a document that restrains government and allows individuals to thrive, to pursue their calling in life, their economic pursuits, but also to pursue their religious life as well. And they do this for all. This is for the common good, regardless of your religious persuasion. Regardless of your political philosophy, this document and these ideals benefit all of us, don't they?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. So in my book, Did America Have a Christian Founding? I argue for a variety of ways in which I think the founders were informed by their Christian convictions when they created the U.S. Constitution and more broadly state constitutions and bills of rights and that sort of thing. And these certainly included things like a constitutional order characterized by the rule of law, separation of powers, checks and balances. The Constitution itself prohibits religious tests for office, and the Anti-Federalists recognized, wait a minute, this means a Jew or a Muslim or an atheist could be president of the United States, and the Federalists had to say, yeah, that's right, that's a possibility. Now, they usually went on to say, but that will never happen, and of course, they've been proven wrong in that with respect to at least non-Christians holding seats in Congress. But then we went on to add the First Amendment to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the 14th Amendment. All of which I think are aimed at guaranteeing the natural rights that the founders were convinced that we had. So we don't need the government to tell us that we have a right to worship God according to the dictates of conscience or to act upon our religious convictions, but the First Amendment does a good job of guaranteeing that right, of protecting that right against the federal government, and state constitutions all have similar protections to protect us against from the state government.
Yeah, very good. Going back to what some of the academics are charging after the J6 Capitol riots, many blamed Christian nationalists for the attack. Mark, is there any evidence to support those claims?
There is virtually no evidence to support this claim. If you scroll through the footage of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, which must be unequivocally condemned, I want to be crystal clear about that, what you will see is a sea of American flags, a sea of MAGA hats, a sea of Trump flags, and an occasional Christian image. There was, I believe, one Christian flag, the sort of flag you might see in a Southern Baptist church in the American South. There was one Christian flag among the rioters. There were two Confederate flags. So there were twice as many Confederate flags as Christian flags. There is a picture of a crazy goth-looking guy holding the Bible in front of the rioters. This crazy Viking guy said a prayer in the Capitol Rotunda. Yeah, so there's some Christian images and language involved. But basically, it just seems to be a bunch of Trump lovers who believe that the election was stolen, who are acting very, very inappropriately, and they are properly arrested and tried and that sort of thing. But to attribute it simply and solely to Christian nationalism, as so many news accounts did, as so many academics like Samuel Perry did, is just utterly ridiculous, and the evidence doesn't bear that out.
Very good. Thank you for clarifying that. Mark, we're coming to an end here. What would you say to Christians right now who care deeply about our country, and yet they don't want to get involved with controversy? They don't like conflict. What would you say to those Christians right now who are maybe thinking of sitting on the sidelines, not voting, or they're maybe just frustrated with the state of our politics, and they're seriously considering staying home? What would you say to them?
I would say there's absolutely no excuse for simply staying home, right? You can go to the voting booth, and nowadays in most states, you don't even have to go to a voting booth. Get an absentee ballot, a mail-in ballot, and vote, right? That's the least you can do. I certainly understand that you might not want to stand up in a public meeting and get involved in an argument with someone over the issues of abortion, but some of us are called to do that. And I think that people are called to different things, so we should be as politically active as we feel called to, but voting is the bare minimum.
Very good. Mark David Hall, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. The book is called Who's Afraid of Christian Nationalism? I believe it can be found on Amazon and other places that sell books. Mark, again, thank you for your good work, and it's great to have you on the Commonwealth Matters.
Thank you very much, Richard.